Welcome into the Towel Boys. I'm Tyler Bintoff. I'm along with me, Mike Grimala. He's over at RunReps.com. I'm over here at Mountain West Connection. Just a note, we're recording this before San Diego State and Wyoming play in the Mountain West title game. So if we make any references to that that seem off, that's why. But UNLV, season's done. They're not going to any postseason tournament. Lost to San Diego State third time this year. They arguably could have or should have won that game in the last few minutes. But I want to start with this. Fill in the blank for me with as many words as you want, Mike. Okay. This season was blank.
It was somewhat of a rebuilding season from the start. I think most people understood that going in, and yet still can't help but feel like it was an underachievement.
I would say it was disappointing but fun. I think, you know, basically Dave Rice kind of sold it as a rebuild sort of from the beginning. Not so much that, hey, we're going to be bad, but more or less that, hey, we're actually going to go with freshmen. But I still think the expectation of NCAA tournament was there just because of how good the freshmen were supposed to be, and Chris Wood for that matter. And so even, what did they, was it 18-3? Was that their final record? Or, I mean, 18-13? That was their final record, right?
18-15.
Okay. All right. Giving them a little bit too much credit there. Okay. But yeah, to me, and we've talked about it before, like, there was so much that I enjoyed about watching UNLV this year, whether it was Pat McCaw or Chris Wood or Rashad Vaughn or Okonobo blocking shots. Like, there was a lot I enjoyed, but ultimately when you look at 18-15 and you look at a seventh place finish in the Mountain West, you know, disappointing is probably being being too nice to say it was just disappointing.
Well, I would say that you probably are an outlier in terms of the way that you watch basketball. I don't think that, like, the casual UNLV fan gets as excited about a good elevator screen as you would. Like, that's something that may excite you. They ran one in the San Diego State game.
They didn't use that. They used that play in the beginning of the year. They didn't use it for like 15 games, and then they busted it out against San Diego State. I thought that was weird.
And that may be enough to keep you excited, but I would say that most UNLV fans, the thing that sort of sticks with them from this season is they led a lot of these games right up until, you know, the final 6 minutes, the final 8 minutes, and ended up losing. And when you just lose that many close games, you know, night after night after night, I think that sort of becomes the final impression of the team. And
that's sort of why I still just say disappointing and not disaster or whatever word you'd want to say, because, like, if you look at the season and take one game, how many times can you pick out one game on this schedule and say that was awful? I can think of like four: losing to Reno at home, the Utah State game, and then Arizona State and Stanford. Like, four times this year UNLV looked just really bad, but every other game they were doing something well. They just weren't doing everything well. And so that's why, you know, it's like, if you look at efficiency differential, they were fifth in the Mountain West in efficiency differential. Like, they weren't far off. And if you look at, you know, point differential, or, you know, you can probably, I don't know what the actual number is, but you can probably say UNLV was 15 points away from like 24 wins or something stupid like that. So to me, that's why I don't think it was a disaster. I just thought it was disappointing. But I also, and I said this last show, I almost feel like we're being fooled into thinking next year's going to be a lot better, because at some point, if you just keep losing 3- and 4-point games, you're just not a good team.
Mm-hmm. And if you're counting on all the freshmen that played this year to get, you know, incrementally better across the board to make up those 2 points, those 3 points differentials that you're losing these games by, I mean, that's what you're banking on for next year, assuming that you can replace the production that's going to be leaving.
We'll get to Dave Rice in a second, but it's just assuming he's here, because I don't know, I guess things might be changing, but there hasn't been anything serious indicating that he wouldn't be here. But assuming he's here, what's UNLV's ceiling next year?
Ceiling, if everything goes right, everyone comes back, everyone is healthy, engaged, I say that's a Sweet 16 team in terms of talent, in terms of roster.
Can they actually get there, though? If they have Vaughn, Woods, Zimmerman, McCaw, Okonobo, Derek Jones, Cornish, can they actually get to Sweet 16?
See, I wasn't even including Zimmerman. I'm just including people that are on the roster now. I mean, you've got – I mean, Chris Wood was a finalist for top power forward of the year. Rashad Vaughn was a finalist for the shooting guard of the year, like these college basketball awards. Another year for those guys, like that's, I don't see it like a lot of teams in the country that can sort of match that level of talent. If those guys were to come back, I think they could do that.
See, that to me would be their ceiling to me too. I don't think they would actually get there even if everybody came back. But I think that is the ceiling. But there's that as the ceiling and what we're assuming there, because I just assumed like 16 things, that Rice will be back, Vaughn will be back, Wood will be back, and Zimmerman's coming to UNLV. Those are four pretty big things. I don't know if that actually happens. But Dave Rice, okay. So Taylor Byrne, and I think even Matt Eumanns over at the Review Journal, both of them reported that Dave Rice is going to talk to Tina Kunzer-Murphy, basically about... I guess about this season, about where they're going in the future, which is, I don't know. I feel like athletic directors sit down with their coach at the end of every season. So I don't think that's necessarily big news, mm-hmm. but just the fact that they went 18-13 and two different papers have reported like, hey, they're going to talk. Does that say anything to you? Like, oh, maybe he's not as safe as everybody assumes right now.
I can't imagine that it would be a termination meeting or something where his job would be seriously on the line, considering just his contract status, that they just extended him less than 12 months ago through to the end of the 2018-2019 season. So they owe him money. And for a school that does not have a lot of athletic funding, I can't see that they would be ready to let him go already before that extension even kicks in.
Yeah, to add the extra layer to this whole idea of could they fire Dave Rice is it's really hard for college athletic departments to fire their football and basketball coach in the same year. And especially for UNLV, who's not exactly swimming in cash. Now, Bobby Houck, they paid him $400,000. I don't know if it was ever reported, but supposedly that money might have come from the Fertittas or Station Casinos, so maybe they didn't pony up the $400,000 themselves. But Bobby Houck still got $400,000 to go away. Now they're paying Tony Sanchez. I think they're paying him $500,000. And then if they were to fire Dave Rice, they would owe him $300,000 a year through the 2019 season when his contract is up. So I don't know that UNLV would be in a situation that they could financially fire him without you know, some booster coming in and saying, I'll pay for it.
And that's what I think would – I mean, that's what would have to happen if they wanted to cut bait with him this early is, you know, you would need some movement from the boosters – who would be willing to pay money not only for the buyout, but if you're going to get rid of Dave Rice, I feel like you'd have to bring in someone established, like someone who's established a better career track record than Dave Rice. I don't think you can get rid of Dave Rice and then hire an assistant coach from, you know, some smaller program or, you know, an up-and-coming name. I think you've got to go with an established guy after you just went with a first-time head coach in Dave Rice. I don't think you would fire him to go with another first timer, and then those guys don't come cheap. If you're looking for an established guy, if you're looking for a guy who's got, you know, a Sweet 16 or Final Four on his resume, those guys aren't cheap. So then you'd probably need the boosters to again mobilize and sort of pitch in financially to pay that guy more than you're paying Dave Rice now.
Yeah, we'll get into Paige's coach's pay at some point, probably in the off season. But Dave Rice gets $700,000. A year, he can earn some bonuses and make that a little bit higher. But $700,000 a year, that is tied for fourth highest in the Mountain West. And it, you know, if you look at teams that went to the NCAA tournament last year, at-large teams, there was only one coach that got paid less than that. So UNLV is not paying Dave Rice a lot of money.
They're not paying him NCAA tournament money, is basically what you're saying.
No, not at all. Not even close, because the majority of coaches in the NCAA tournament that aren't, you know, the automatic qualifier coaches are making like $2 million a year. Lon Kruger at Oklahoma, who, you know, just left here, he's making triple what Dave Rice makes. So UNLV is not exactly paying Dave Rice a lot of money. They're not, you know, he may have had back-to-back disappointing seasons, but it's not like UNLV sinking a whole lot of money into that. They didn't exactly lose a lot financially from that standpoint. But I don't, like, it would have to be boosters, like, that would pay for a new coach, because I don't think you're getting anything better than Dave Rice for $700,000 a year. Like, to me, the only way you do that is if you hire a first-time head coach and he turns out to be really good. But like you said, I don't think they take that chance. Like, if they were going for a new coach, I don't think you go hire, okay, this guy has been assistant for 10 years at wherever, we're going to give him a shot. But that's the only way you get a really good coach for cheap, is to take a chance on a guy that's never coached before. And I don't see them doing that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they did with Rice. They got he was an assistant coach at BYU. Who had never been a head coach before, and they brought him in and took a chance on him because he had a reputation as a good recruiter, as a good offensive guy. And they took a chance on him as a first timer. I don't see them, if you're going to get rid of Rice under these circumstances and pay him to go away, I don't see them replacing him with someone who basically has the same resume as he did when he was hired.
At $700,000 a year, Dave Rice is a bargain of a recruiter for UNLV. That's they're getting tremendous value on the recruiting standpoint.
Oh, best money they ever spent.
Now, in terms of in-game coaching, there may be overpaying him a little bit. But if you just compare pay to Dave Rice's, what Dave Rice does, I don't feel like he's overpaid.
I mean, well, reportedly the offer he had on the table from South Florida last offseason was 1.3.
Yeah.
So I mean, if he got an offer of 1.3, then by definition, that's his market value. Like, someone's willing to pay him that, I would say that's his market value.
That right there is what I think underlines where UNLV is right now. South Florida,
school with no basketball reputation. That is not a basketball school. That is not a team with the history and the prestige of UNLV, with everything that they... UNLV is a team that has won a national championship. They had a team that was, like, at the forefront of, like, the cultural zeitgeist of the 80s and 90s. Like, that, South Florida does not have that, and they were willing to double your coach's pay. Like, that says something about where UNLV is in terms of athletics and how much they're willing to pay. And I guess, like, if you're going to get rid of Dave Rice, you've got to be swing for the fences to replace him.
Yeah, because if South Florida's offering 1.3, you've obviously got to pay more than that, or a coach would be like, well, why would I come there for less than $1 million when I can get $1 million basically anywhere else that would have a coaching vacancy? Take out the money. Dave Rice this year, does he deserve to be fired? Just this year, was there enough to say, okay, they should fire him based on performance?
Well, I would say no. He, from everything that I understand, this was the plan. Like, he told, when he got the extension, he told Tina Kunze Murphy and, you know, the rest of the athletic department that this was the plan. He wanted an extension. He wanted some long-term security so that he could sign a big freshman class, and then sort of let them develop and build some stability within the program. So his first few years, they had been relying a lot on transfers. They had been relying a lot on one-year guys, you know, guys left over from the Lon Kruger era, guys that were transferring in for 1 or 2 years. So it wasn't really – he never had a stable foundation of recruits. A lot of the guys that he brought in, which I guess you could blame some of that on him, you know, were one-and-done guys, whether they were, you know, off to the NBA or transferring out. So this was, I guess, he said, you know, he wanted to bring in a class that could stabilize the program, guys that would be around for a few years. If you're bringing a true freshman and you're going to play him, you can't expect, you know, 25 wins in the regular season. You're going to expect some growing pains. So if they were on board with that plan, last offseason when they gave him the extension. I don't see how you can fault him for carrying through with that plan.
The way I kind of look at the season and again just this year is I don't feel like Dave Rice really ever did anything that would I can't remember anything where it was like that was just an awful decision and he shouldn't have done that and they lost a game because of it. Maybe they played zone defense a lot against Arizona State, right? Or am I confusing that with Stanford? I might be confusing those two. That's like the only thing I can think back to and say, well, that looked kind of foolish and that was dumb. Like there was nothing in game that I say that was awful. He should go because he kept doing that. I will say there was a lot of times though where I thought they should do this or they could be doing more here. So to me, he didn't do anything really deserved to be fired, but he didn't do anything to kind of stand out or do anything that was like, oh, that was great consistently enough.
Mm-hmm. More so than the X's and like I don't go into the X's and O's as much as you do. If I'm going to levy a criticism at Dave Rice after his 4 years here, it's that in more of a big picture sense, I don't think he's built any sort of team identity. I wrote about this yesterday on runrevs.com. Is that I still don't know what the team's identity is. I still don't know what kind of team they're supposed to be. You know, it's
Chris Wood's team.
It's sort of
Chris Wood's team.
If you ask Dave Rice, he'll say our identity is we play hard, we play together. But I mean, that's not really an identity. That's more of a slogan. His first couple of years, he wanted to be a run and gun team. He wanted to play the fast pace. He kind of backed off of that. They've sort of switched up defenses a little bit. He wanted to be a pressure defense. Pressure man-to-man, full-court press, trapping, creating turnovers. They kind of backed off that. They mix in some zone now. I still don't know exactly what kind of team they want to be. And I guess maybe some of that is because of the roster instability that he's had the first few years. So maybe now that he's got some guys that are supposed to, be here for next year and the year after that, he can sort of implement something long-term. That would be my biggest criticism.
Can you build a team identity around Pat McCaw?
Maybe I would want the ball in his hands a lot next year. I think we talked about this last week. Offensively, yeah. I would want the ball in his hands, screen and roll from different angles all game.
Yeah, and we talked about it before too. Pat McCaw would be the guy that would flourish the most if they played a higher pressure defense, and we don't know that the rest of the roster could really keep that up, but I feel like if you were to take a player and say, okay, we're going to have an identity and it's going to play to this guy's strengths, you would do that with Pat McCaw.
Yeah.
And, I don't know. We don't know exactly what the roster will look like next year, so it might not actually be feasible to do that. But I think that would be kind of the easy/smart thing to do if you were going to say, okay, we just need to revamp what we do at UNLV and we need to play to somebody's strengths, it would be let's play to Pat McCaw's strengths. Now, I do want to take a moment to talk about Dave Rice and the San Diego State game, because in the first 20 minutes, Dave Rice killed Steve Fisher in terms of coaching. It wasn't close. The first 16 points of the game for UNLV, 8 of them came off of Steve Fisher sending a double team at either Chris Wood or Good Luck Okonobo, and the other 8 came off of UNLV breaking San Diego State's press. Like, the two things their defenses are known for being good at and giving teams difficulties with, UNLV crushed them in the first half.
When you went back and looked at it, were they the same type of double teams into the post that they were sending at him in the game, the final regular season game a week ago?
Yeah, it was basically Chris Wood catches outside the block, so like 5 feet outside the block. They send their second big man to double. And what that leaves, and UNLV had basically the same spacing as they had in the games before, but what that left was, I think usually it was Winston Shepherd would then kind of slide, rotate in off the backside wing to take away the pass to Good Luck Okonobo under the basket. But what UNLV did, the very first possession, was they took Jalon Kendrick from that wing, and he just cut straight to the heart of the lane, and Winston Shepherd couldn't guard Okonobo and Kendrick and would just pass it to whoever was open. And that's how Kendrick got it in there. That's how Okonobo got a couple dunks. And the weird thing was, they double-teamed Okonobo twice in the same spot, and that was weird to me because that's the last, maybe Kendrick is, but that's the second to last guy you would double if you're San Diego State. And Okonobo was able to beat it. So it's like their double team, they crushed it. And so much so that Steve Fisher stopped. He, like, usually they send the double team, like, as the pass is coming. They did a couple times, they sent the double team on the bounce. So when Chris Wood dribbled the ball, they sent the double team, and that was kind of effective. But ultimately, they just stopped double teaming him in the second half. And that's why Chris Wood went off. And it's the same thing we saw against Arizona. When you can't double team him, you can't stop him. I mean, he's going to get the shot he wants to get most of the time. And that's what, I mean, that's why he went off in the second half, was because they stopped doubling him. And it was, and really, I mean, it wasn't like Dave Rice did anything incredible. He just sent one guy on a cut, but it was that simple of a solution that just totally shut down that trap from San Diego State and allowed Chris Wood to get one-on-one matchups in the second half.
It was pretty, that first half went as well as UNLV probably could have scripted it. That was the first half that they wanted to play. I thought they controlled the game. I thought that they looked better than they had. I mean, I know that they had first half leads against San Diego State in the first two games as well, but I thought that that was the best that they had played against San Diego State this season. They actually, you know, they looked prepared. They looked, you know, crisp, and they were getting the type of shots that they wanted. Defensively, they were playing well. I mean, you don't have to play amazing defense against San Diego State to keep them off the board, but I thought they played well there too. And then the second half, you mentioned that, you know, they stopped doubling Chris Wood. How did the game get away from UNLV again? I mean, that was a sort of the story of the season. Was, you know, they big allowing big runs at the start of the second half, and then not being able to get stops defensively down the stretch, I feel like were the two sort of fatal flaws of this team, and we saw both of those things against San Diego State. That's kind of how it goes when your season ends, is that whatever your biggest problems were during the season tend to crop up when you're eliminated, and I thought that's what happened to UNLV in that game.
I have no clue what happened in the first 5 minutes of games, because I've watched some of the first or second halves. I mean, first 5 minutes, second halves of these games where they blow the lead. It's never really the same thing that happens. It's just they come out of the locker room and they're not as good for 5 minutes. Against San Diego State, I think it was a 10-0 run to start the half for San Diego State. It should have been like 8-4 or something, because UNLV, they broke the press twice and got to the rim and got fouled, and they went over for the free throw line. So it could have, you know, should have been at 8-4 or 8-3 at some point, which certainly would have helped stem their run. But I don't, for the whole season, it's just the weirdest 5 minutes, because it's never the same thing. It's always different because the opponent's always different. I will say this, in the second half, Dave Rice did something really dumb, and he sent post doubles at J.J. O'Brien. And when he did that, San Diego State just kicked it out to the perimeter, and they moved it around until the pass beat UNLV's rotation, and it ended up with Akeel Quinn getting like four open threes in the second half. Winston Shepherd got two, and I think he knocked them both down. Like, they got open threes because, like, Dave Rice was trying to double J.J. O'Brien in the post, and then UNLV couldn't rotate quick enough. And San Diego State's not a great shooting team. It's not an awful strategy, but it just left guys wide open. Like, the rotation was too slow. It just, guys were just completely wide open.
Like, and I know that Dave Rice really respects J.J. O'Brien. He'll talk about J.J. O'Brien for, you know, 5-10 minutes at a time. They recruited him. They wanted him when he was shopping himself around. It, you know, he chose San Diego State, but UNLV wanted him. Dave Rice wanted him. He loves him. Maybe a case of respecting him on the court a little bit too much. I don't think J.J. O'Brien, I know he beat Chris Wood one-on-one at least once in the second half. He beat him baseline for a layup. But I'm willing to let it ride with that matchup, as opposed to doubling and getting my entire defense out of whack. Even against San Diego State, which is not a team that's not built to kill you with three-pointers and, you know, perimeter shooting, I would still rather let Chris Wood see if he can get him under control.
There was an article on realgm.com, and it's based on the NBA, and you can't translate everything from the NBA to college because guys don't shoot as well. But basically it was pointing out doubling a post player is infinitely stupid, because the efficiency of a post-up is one of the least efficient play types in basketball, but the efficiency from passing out of a post-up double team is you get open threes all the time when you pass out of a double in the post. So basically it was saying, don't double the post because you're going to give up open threes, and you're going to give up more points over the course of a season giving up open threes than you are letting the post player just score.
I believe it. If you're talking the NBA, I shook my head for, 15 straight years when teams would send double teams at Tim Duncan all game long, when you know that Tim Duncan doesn't want to score 30 points. He just wants to wait for the double team so that he can kick it out and move it around for three-pointers, and yet teams would constantly double-team him in the post. Is J.J. O'Brien a guy that, what is he, 11, 12 points a game? I'm not sure his exact numbers, but I think I'd rather challenge him to put the team on his back offensively and beat me shooting the ball than I would be letting them kick it out against a double-team and working it around. Unless you're trying to force turnovers with, trapping and pressure, which is not the MO of the UNLV defense.
Yeah, and even in that case, the other three players that aren't doubling for UNLV aren't good enough to force enough of those. Like they don't have good enough defenders to jump passing lanes and do it well enough to actually create turnovers and whatever, get going the other way. Now season's over; they're not playing in the CBI. Dave Rice, Tina Kunzer-Murphy both cited, hey, we don't have Thomas and Mac. We can't play at the Orleans. We're not going to do it in the Cox Pavilion. So we don't really have a place to play. They don't really want to go on the road, apparently, and they only have 7 healthy players at this point. But before they kind of made that decision and the discussion was should they play in it or not, I heard and saw a lot of people saying that it's an embarrassment to play in the CBI. And my question was just, is it more of an embarrassment to play in the CBI than to not play in any postseason basketball? It's not good to go to the CBI. You obviously have higher goals than that, but it's not like UNLV's deciding between the NIT and the CBI. They're deciding between the CBI and no postseason basketball. And I don't understand the argument that the CBI is embarrassing.
I think for some fans, it is. I personally, my belief would be that with a team this young, an extra week of practices and, another game, another 40 minutes of real game action probably has some value for the guys that are going to be here next year. But I think a lot of fans don't want to see an empty Thomas and Mack where you're playing some, an also-ran from some other conference with no one in the arena and no intensity really in the game, with no consequences. It's basically an exhibition game. I think some fans just don't want – it's kind of hurts to see your team in that position, whereas if you just let the season end, it's over.
I guess. I don't know. I just – there were a couple things I was excited for if they played in the CBI. One is there was a 30-second shot clock and whatever. Not that that – I don't think that would make a huge difference, but that's – the CBI is going to have a 30-second shot clock this year. The other thing was if UNLV made it to the title game, it was a best-of-3 series, and my God, I want to cover a college basketball postseason series. Like, that, to me, that would be awesome.
That's a good idea.
Like, granted, they would be, Siena won the thing last year, so it'd be a 3-game series with Siena. But still, I would be, I love NBA playoffs, because, especially if you really focus on one of them, you can pay attention, and this is whatever. Like you said, I watch basketball and get enjoyment from different things, but you can see different adjustments from game to game. I would love to see that.
That's when coaching comes out. I mean, that's when you really can tell, take your measure of a coach is when he's coaching the same team, the same coach, 3 games, 4 games, 5 games in a row. That's when you can really see adjustments, and everything is sort of comes out under the light.
Yeah, so those are two things I would have been really excited for. Now, granted, I think they would have had to win three or four games. I can't remember how many teams in the CBI. 3 or 4 games to get to the final. But regardless, a little disappointed, but not broken up about them not playing in the CBI. Okay, now we're going to talk about the media. A couple things have happened during this Mountain West tournament. But first, let's start with Chris Wood saying that San Diego State should be very worried. Or was it really worried? I don't remember if it was very or really.
Yeah.
All right. He got baited. Here's the question that was asked by Mark Ziegler of the San Diego Union-Tribune. The full question, it was, quote, "The last two times you played San Diego State, they played 10 guys, they press, tried to take the legs out of you, you just played tonight, how are your legs, are you tired, or should San Diego State be worried?" Like, it's the most, like, that, loaded, baiting question I've ever heard.
It's loaded. It's an awful question. Because, first of all, it's a double question, which you should, as a journalist, if you learn how to interview people, you should never ask a double question, because you're only going to get an answer for the second question that you ask. Secondly, the entire question is about your legs and your stamina. He tacks on the "should you be worried" at the very end, because he knows that the entire question is about his legs, but Chris Wood is only going to answer the second question. So he's sort of setting him up. And it's a San Diego State writer, so, you know, that's the perspective that he wants. So he sort of sets up Chris Wood to, hey, are you guys going to be tired? You've been tired against San Diego State. You falter in the second half against San Diego State. You're tired. Are you going to be tired, or should San Diego State be worried? Presented – now, Chris Wood, you know, presented – he just played a basketball game. He's answering a bunch of different questions. When presented with that question and that setup, his two options are you so tired that you're going to get run off the floor by San Diego State, or should they be worried about you? Given those two options, he said they should be worried.
It was he set up a false dichotomy, which is when you present somebody with two options and make it appear as though those are the only two options.
Exactly.
When they really aren't. I mean,
and but if you're San Diego State writer, congratulations, you were more clever than a 17-year-old kid. Good job, I guess.
I mean, listen, he did, like, he was, that's what he was trying to do, and he accomplished it. Like, in terms of achieving a goal, he nailed it, like, in terms of getting that question and getting the answer he wanted. Like you said, athletes, coaches, if you ask them a question, the only thing they remember is the last thing you said.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I do this, a lot of people that interview people do, like, You have something you want to ask them. You don't know how to say it. You just start talking, and you sort of talk yourself into a circle, and you finally sort of get a half-assed question out. That happens, and a lot of times that's where you get, you know, players that are like, "What in the hell is going on? What am I answering here?" But to me, I don't really think that's what happened. I think he sort of was rambling about being tired, but he wanted that to be the
soundbite or the tweet bite that he could get. He wanted a little bit of a Twitter fodder that he could put out there after the press conference, saying that, you know, Chris Wood says San Diego State should be very worried about UNLV.
Now, if you're Chris Wood, should he have answered that how Dave Rice would have answered?
Well,
it,
Dave
Rice would have completely ignored the "should they be worried" part. He would have just gone and said, "Oh yeah, we're not going to be."
Well,
too
what
tired
was about funny about the press conference was Chris Wood gave his answer, which was, "Yeah, you know, they should be worried. You know, we're going to be ready to play." And then Jordan Cornish jumped in and was going to give his version of an answer, and Dave Rice, like, immediately in the way that the Mountain West sets up their post-game press conferences, the athletes, you ask all your questions for the players first, and then they dismiss the players. And then the coach, sort of, who is sitting with him at the podium, the coach stays behind, and then he answers his questions. They want to get the players out of there as quick as possible. So we're asking, you know, the players their questions. And then when Jordan Cornish was about to answer, Dave Rice, like, breaking protocol for maybe the first and only time in his entire life, jumped in and sort of cut him off and said, and then did his Dave Ricean answer about, you know, we respect San Diego State because we know they're so good. I'm worried. Steve Fisher's worried. Everyone's worried because it's that time of year when, you know, you have to be worried. So he, like, tried to spin it as best he can, but like, that soundbite was already out there. The look on his face when Chris Wood said it was priceless.
Does, like, to me, because I don't think trash talk leading up to a game actually factors into what happens in the game, but, like, I love trash talk, and people are like, oh, you know, and if you don't want to incite any trash talk, yes, Chris Wood needs to be smarter and not say that, but to me, I don't care because it makes it more fun, and I covered Marshall Henderson for 2 years. Like, to me, and maybe that's what's affected me, I love trash talk in basketball beforehand and just people that are cocky or whatever. I want to see more of that. So I'm glad he asked that because it, whatever, it started that whole, oh my God, why San Diego State fans, what should we be worried about? Winning the whole tournament or whatever? So you can say Chris Wood should be smarter and answer the question differently, but to me, I say no. I'm glad he didn't answer it differently because
how would the 1990 Running Rebels have answered that question if you put one of those guys on the podium after a game?
Are the 1990 Rebels, are they 18-15 or are they 30-2?
Yeah, so like, and as far as trash talk goes, I think that's pretty tame if you can even qualify that as trash talk. But yeah, it just goes to show you like how the media can sort of get what they want.
I will give credit to Mark Ziegler because he did put in his story, when Chris Wood was asked if San Diego State should be worried, he said blank. So he did give a little bit of context to it that, you know, because you could write it and just make it seem like Chris Wood came out and said, and San Diego State should be worried just all by himself, which, but he did write it as though somebody asked him that.
Did he write it and include both choices that he gave him, or did he just say that when he was asked if they should be worried?
I think he gave both choices.
Okay.
I'd have to double check. I think he did give both choices.
Okay.
I was actually surprised he did anything. I was almost expecting him to lead with Chris Woods says San Diego State should be worried, and just basically that be it. Okay, other thing in media that has happened is Ed Graney. All right. Before we get into what's happened at the Thomas and Mac, I want to start with Twitter, and apparently he's blocked a bunch of people on Twitter, and there's a ton of people, UNLV fans, that don't like him. First, there's no real reason to be mad at Ed Graney. Are you really mad at Ed Graney, or are you mad that UNLV sucks this year? That's the first thing. The second thing is, in this, you know, Ed Graney is arguing with people on Twitter, and people are yelling at him about being a terrible columnist or whatever it is. Somebody said he's not an objective. I keep trying to say objection. I don't know. He's not an objective reporter. And he responded, and so did Adam Hill, who writes for the Review Journal as well, saying that's not his job to be an objective reporter, which I thought was weird because, yes, he is a columnist, and yes, it's kind of sort of his job to be like a Skip Bayless for the Las Vegas area. Like, he's supposed to say things that make you upset. But he's still supposed to be objective. Just the way they both said it, like, that's not his job, made it seem like Ed Graney doesn't have to worry about facts when he writes.
I think being objective and being factual are two different things. If you're a reporter, if you're a journalist in any way, columnist, reporter, editor, anything, you have to be factual. You have to make sure that you get everything right, and you have to be correct. For if you're a columnist for newspaper, objective is it depends. Like, if you're hiring a columnist, you're hiring them to give opinions. Like, that is like their job. So opinion is not always going to be objective. If that makes sense. I mean,
yeah.
If you're a sports fan, you like the players that you like the teams that you like. That's not an objective decision that you made. You came to those decisions, or you take those stances based on, you know, emotional responses that you have, your personal feelings. I think that a columnist is supposed to, you know, let those things drive their writing and their takes on different subjects. Where I think you can get into trouble as a columnist is if you're disingenuous in any way. If you present yourself as being truthful, but really you have like a hidden agenda. Yeah. I'm not sure this is completely hypothetical. I'm not a big reader of opinion columns. I don't really make it a point to read columnists. Just I'm not that interested in it. But if Ed Graney is purporting to be truthful and saying, you know, that he's objective about UNLV, but really he's, you know, rooting against UNLV secretly or something like that, which is that's like completely hypothetical. I'm being honest. I don't read like the columns. I don't really know what his whole persona is. But something like that could be disingenuous, and that could make people dislike you. I don't know, what's going on there. But it does. It was hard to avoid this past week the amount of vitriol that he was receiving from.
Yes, tell me what was happening. Well, people were yelling at him.
The Mountain West Conference, Mountain West Tournament, the first two games, the two UNLV games, he was sitting in media row, and my seat was right behind him, and the fans were right behind me, and it wasn't even the UNLV student section. It wasn't even like a UNLV section. I think it was like a general seating section. And all game long, there was just a pocket of fans just heckling Ed Graney, like throughout the entire game, like. A play like a Chris Wood would make a shot, and they'd be, you know, hey, write that in your notebook. Are you writing that down, Ed? What are you going to say about that, Ed? Just all game long, just completely verbally harassing him throughout the entire. And it was very for those two, especially the first game against UNR. There were not a lot of people there. You could hear like every word. He could hear like every word. So yeah, like that was the situation for him.
So that to me, it's hilarious. But it's also like I said, are you really mad at Ed Graney, or are you mad that UNLV sucks?
The guy's just doing his job, you know? He's just sitting there. He's just, you know, trying to do his job. He's watching the game. He's trying to, you know.
Like, here's the thing with Graney, who's a columnist. Any columnist, or this is basically the Skip Bayless rule. If you get that annoyed with him, the best thing to do is to just ignore it. Don't read what he writes. You know, if you want to take it a step further, and I saw people saying, let's boycott the Review Journal until Ed Graney's gone or whatever. Like, that's what you do to... Because if you're Ed Graney, if you're a columnist, if you're the Review Journal and your columnist is getting heckled and people on Twitter are pissed at him, he's doing his job. He is doing it very well, because that's the whole point. They want you to read his hot takes. They want you to be upset or offended by his hot takes. Like, that's what they want. So if you're that mad at him, you just have to ignore it. That's the only way to, like, make it go away.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand, like, as a columnist, I guess his job is to take a stand. Whether it's unpopular or not, it's really up to him. Whether it's what he's writing, what he believes. So in that sense, I guess his job is not to be objective. His job is to take a stand that he believes in. So if he believes that UNLV is not on the right track and he's writing that, which I'm guessing is what's happening since the fans are angry at him, if he's taking a stand that, you know, is against UNLV, then I'm sure that's what he believes, and that's his job, is to, you know, take that stand.
I want to say one thing completely off topic of UNLV that I saw on Twitter. So from some, like, here's the thing. If I'm bored and I'm on my phone on Twitter, I just start clicking on things and I end up, like, looking at God knows what. And somehow I always find people with, like, 12 followers that have an egg profile picture that say something completely ridiculous and always makes me more upset than it should. But I just wanted to share one with you. Somebody yesterday said that Derek Marks isn't any good. He's just a volume scorer. Which is the most ridiculous thing I've ever said. He shot 51% this year from the field. Like, he should have shot the ball more for Boise State. Derek Marks is awesome. He sucked against Wyoming, but Derek Marks is awesome. So if you go find the one guy with the egg profile picture that said he's a terrible player and a volume scorer, that's what I'm talking about. I just wanted to completely derail this and let
you
know.
Were you so offended by that tweet that you blocked that user?
I did not, because it's not like he tweeted it at me. I just...
Principle.
I should have, yeah. I don't know. I should have just blocked him, and I don't know. I just couldn't believe somebody actually thinks, like, Derek Marks shooting more is a bad thing. Like, he had a terrible game against Wyoming. He's had about 3 bad games all year. Otherwise, he's shooting 51%. He should shoot it every time he could. All right. Mike, last show, we talked about what annoys you in terms of backing into parking spots. Just to let you know, I think I've backed into 2 parking spots since the last time we did it just for you. I'm just hopeful, like, you magically happen to be in the same place and I see you mad in your car and I step out and you're just like, what the hell? But I know what annoys me. And it happens at concerts. And it's people at a concert who think they need to record entire songs on their phone.
Okay.
Like, I'm sure those are going to be great videos when you go back and watch it. Like, they're going to be awful videos.
See, I think that people who record songs on their phones are the best.
Oh, shut up, Mike.
Because then those videos oftentimes make it onto YouTube or some internet website where I can then watch them. You know, if, say,
no,
if the killers are coming to town and I want to know, like, what they're up to, what the show is going to look like, I can just go on YouTube, type it in, Killers Tour 2015, and I'll get every song that they've performed from someone's shaky handheld video, and I can watch it and I can enjoy it. So I think those people are the best.
But you can't enjoy it. Like, I was at a concert, like, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, a week ago, something like that. Somebody in front of me was recording the song, but she was like 5'5", and so all you could see in her phone was the back of somebody's head. Like, it's literally a video of the back of somebody's head with a song in the background. It's got to be the most annoying thing in the world. Like, put your damn phone away and just enjoy the concert.
I don't know. What?
It's awful. It's way worse than backing into parking spots.
I don't see. Yeah, but backing into a parking spot affects me in a tangible way. I don't see how this tangibly affects your ability to enjoy a concert.
What? It completely affects it. It's the most annoying thing ever. If it's somebody that's like 5'8 or taller, now their hand and their phone are right in my face in front of me. And so, one, you're getting a terrible video of it, and two, I can't see the concert anymore because your hand and phone are in the way.
Yeah, but you can go home and then log onto YouTube and watch the song that person recorded.
So I need to ask them what their YouTube username is.
Yeah.
That way I can enjoy the concert later on my own time.
Exactly.
Okay. Oh, I got one more random thing for you, Mike, and it's I want to ask you which one of these names is the best. So the Mountain West Women's Basketball Tournament was also at the Thomas and Mack. Boise State won that. The MVP of the women's tournament was Brooke Powakoa. And for those of you that don't know, I do play-by-play for UNLV's online stream, and I did all their women's basketball games. So I called basically every Mountain West women's team. And Powakoa was probably my favorite name to say. Like, I'm going to try to sell you on it and tell you why it's a good name. Cafe Rio needs to come out with a new meat that is spicy pork that is called Powakoa Barbacoa. Which would be the greatest thing. I don't even like spicy food, but I would order it just so I could say Powakoa Barbacoa. Because it's so much fun to say. The other awesome name in women's basketball is a freshman for Utah State. She's from Australia, and her name is Funda Nakasoglu. Now, her first name is spelled Funda. So it looks like Funda, and I'm assuming it gets mispronounced as Funda quite often because... This is the greatest thing I've ever found in a media guide.
Okay.
In the Utah State Women's Basketball Media Guide, her page or whatever, it says her nickname is Funda from Down Under. And it's the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life in a media guide.
I feel like you're way inside play-by-play broadcaster right now. I feel like this conversation appeals...
We've lost everybody.
This conversation will appeal to the people listening to our podcast who are also play-by-play announcers.
Like, but you've got to agree, Funda from Down Under is the greatest nickname ever.
It is pretty good.
And are either of those better than Good Luck Okonobo?
Maybe if Good Luck had gone somewhere else, but the fact that he's playing in Las Vegas, like, Good Luck in Las Vegas is, like, just amazingly serendipitous.
It's over the top too good.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's not, and you know, his name's Good Luck, and it's not like his last name is Smith, it's Okonobo, which is something nobody else has ever seen either.
Yeah.
It's like he's got some quality on both ends there. Okay.
Here's a topic for next time. For the offseason, why do no UNLV players have good nicknames?
What? I've given plenty of them good nicknames.
Well, good is... it's.
Whoa! They'll be hating on my puns. Calm down now.
But, okay. We can leave that for another time.
Yeah, listen, I will give them all nicknames. I will lock that. If you put me in charge of it, I will handle it from top to bottom. You don't want to put me in charge of it, do you?
Knick-knack Patty Mac is maybe the best one, and I'm not sure that Pat McCall is going to be on board with that.
That one is tremendous, and you know it is. Like, that one is awesome. You don't want to know how proud I was of myself when I thought of that.
Well, I mean... You've got an off season, so go.
I know. I gotta. And see, the best thing with basketball, I don't know. Maybe it's the best. Maybe it's the worst. Is that you've only got like 13 guys, so you can really hone in on those guys and come up with good ones like Knick Knack Patty Mac.
Yeah.
Like, that's a great one. Oh, and on the topic of names, Air Force has a football player whose name is Weston Steelhammer. Which is incredible.
That's a pretty good one.
And I think he's a strong safety. Like, he's on defense, so he tackles people. Like, that's better than Good Luck Okanoba. Like, Weston Steelhammer is just unbelievably awesome for a name. But anyway, Funda from Down Under, but it's actually Funda from Down Under, however you want to do that, and Powakoa Barbacoa. All right, for the three people, it's not even three anymore, Mike. It's I think we're done. Nobody's been listening for the past five.
No one made it to the finish line for this one.
Okay, we'll try to lose you next time with women's basketball in the first 10 minutes of the show rather than the last five. But for Mike Grimala, I'm Tyler Bischoff. This has been the Talisman.